the following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening. This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Well, we made it to a Friday, so there's that. We've got that going for us. Welcome to it. I'm Nicole Sandler here at NicoleSandler.com and on the Progressive Voices Network. And it is just another day in Trump's America, isn't it? A big news from the Wall Street Journal out of Las Vegas, where Steve Wynn, one of the most powerful men, not only in Vegas, but a man, one of the very few who Trump has called a great friend, the man who is the finance chair of the RNC, became that after Trump took office, has been engaged in a pattern of sexual misconduct and pressured employees to perform sex acts. The Wall Street Journal interviewed over 150 people for this story, and they got some horrendous stories out of it. One, a manicurist tells the story. I'm not even going to repeat it here because it's so sickening. This woman was married, was crying, and he basically forced her into having sex with him. He wound up paying her $7.5 million to pay her off. Steve Wynn, the finance chair of the Republican National Committee. Now, forgive me if I'm mistaken here, but Harvey Weinstein, who is another horrendous human being, was not an official in the Democratic Party, yet the Republicans were all a tither, if that's a word, over the fact that Democrats actually took money from Weinstein and they were demanding that they all give it back. There's somebody on Twitter, at Betty Bowers, who I don't know who she is, but she wrote, GOP, quote, if Steve Wynn is a sexual harasser, you need to return every cent he gave you, Hillary. What? He gave it to us? Oh, well, never mind. God has already forgiven him. Are you second guessing God? Because that's how they act. That's the gaslighting nature of the Republican Party today. So far, the RNC has been silent on it. This story broke, an hour or two ago, and it's been all over the Twitters. This guy is really horrendous. Steve Wynn, one of the more powerful. Yes, Betty Bowers is a satirist. I know that. Robert Hill, I don't know much else about her other than she's got a few hundred thousand Twitter followers. She's like the church lady. Yes, so you can tell from the tweet there. She's big on satire. I follow her. She's quite amusing and spot on in this note. So Steve Wynn, what do you do about someone like Steve Wynn, Republicans? Any word on whether or not they'll say anything about him? I think they'll just ignore him and figure if we ignore him, he doesn't exist, right? Because that's how the Republicans act. They deny. Deny. It's like, did you hear this from Davos today? As Donald Trump was walking by, the reporters were shouting at him, did you try to fire Mueller?
Mr. President, did you order Mueller fired?
Fake news, folks.
Fake news.
Typical New York Times fake stories.
Typical New York Times fake stories. That's what he does. He just won't admit it and figures it'll go away because he lies with impunity. Now, Steve Wynn, one of his best friends, who just held a fundraiser for him at Mar-a-Lago in the last week or two, along with Ronna Romney McDaniels, who is the chair of the RNC. How do they disavow themselves of him? And it's the Wall Street Journal. It's not like it's the fake New York Times. The Wall Street Journal, that's one of Rupert Murdoch's papers. You know, it's one on their team, as if, you know, newspapers had teams. Some do. Did you hear what else? Trump sat for his first international television interview while in Davos with Piers Morgan, of all people. Do you remember when this happened? Here, I'm going to play you a news clip from November. This happened.
U.S. President Donald Trump says his retweets of a British ultra-nationalist fringe group's videos are justified, as both the U.K.'s conservative government and their opposition unified in condemnation of their closest ally. Prime Minister Theresa May's office stated that, quote, it is wrong for the president to have circulated the unverified videos, which purport to show Muslims committing violent acts. The president hitting back, responding, don't focus on me, focus on the radical Islamic terrorism in Britain.
So Piers Morgan asked him about it because, you know, this interview was for some British TV show that's going to air on Sunday or Saturday or Sunday. And the story, in case that didn't refresh your memory, I'm sure it did, was Trump retweeted these three videos that turned out to be fake, but they were perpetrated by this Britain First group, an anti-Muslim and Islamophobic group that is, you know, not... understatement of the day, not respected in Great Britain. And it prompted condemnation among British lawmakers at the time. Members of Parliament called his retweeting of these videos fascist, stupid, and spreading evil, right? So Piers Morgan asked him about it. Here's the clip.
Given the amount of offence it caused, do you regret now those retweets? And do you wish you, with hindsight, hadn't done it?
Well, you know, look, it was done because I am a big believer in fighting radical Islamic terror. This was a depiction of radical Islamic terror.
No, they were unverified videos. At least one of them was not what it said.
They are, but this was, I didn't do it. I didn't go out and, I did
yeah,
a
Yeah, you did.
Tweet. It was a big story where you are, but it was not a big story where I am.
Yes, it was.
So you're telling me something like
this. Well, this is airing in Britain, and I want them to get to the real you.
Well, I'll tell you, the real me is somebody that loves Britain, loves the UK, I love Scotland. I wish, you know, one of the biggest problems I have in winning, I won't be able to get back there so often. I would love to go there. As you know, before this happened, I would be there a lot. Very special people and a very special
place. But now
place.
They'll protest
so,
you.
So I don't want to cause any difficulty for your country, that I can tell you.
Can I get an apology out of you just for the retweets of Britain?
Well, if you're
first.
Telling me,
I think it would go a long way.
Then here's what's fair: if you're telling me that's a horrible people, horrible racist people, I would certainly apologize if you'd like me to do that. I know nothing about them.
And you would disavow yourself of people like that.
I don't want to be involved with people, right. But you're telling me about these people because I know nothing about these people.
Oh, he's been told about these people. He knows all about these people. This is like what he said about David Duke. I know nothing about David Duke. I don't know who he is, right? I didn't know that he endorsed me. I don't know anything about him. If you're telling me that they're horrible people, horrible racist people, I would certainly apologize if you'd like me to do that. Gee, that came right from the heart, didn't it? Oh, he's good. He's a good gaslighter, that Trump, isn't he? Well, he's on his way home now. Aren't we lucky? There's a lot to talk about. We've got Luke Vargas coming up from the Talk Media News Service a little bit. And today we're going to speak with a woman who is running for governor of California. Yes, we are. Her name is Delaine Easton. But first, let's find out what's news.
I read the news today.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The New York Times broke a huge story Thursday night, reporting that the president ordered the firing last June of Robert Mueller, the special counsel overseeing the Russia investigation, according to four people told of the matter, but ultimately backed down after the White House counsel threatened to resign rather than carry out the directive. Michael Schmidt called into Chris Hayes' MSNBC show just as the story broke with details.
If you look back at June, it's a month after Mueller has been appointed and the White House has experienced the firing of Comey and seen the enormous impact that that had. And McGahn was deeply concerned about it and was willing to put his job on the line to try and stop it.
You have four different people telling this. What was the context or the trigger for the president wanting to fire Mueller?
Well, the president thought that Mueller had conflict of interest issues. The president thought that Mueller, who had been a member of his golf club in Northern Virginia, had a dispute about membership fees, and that was one of the reasons he had to go. The other reason being that Mueller had worked at a law firm that represented Jared Kushner, and that Mueller had interviewed to be the FBI director the day before he was made special counsel. And the president thought that those were things that were reasons for him not to oversee the Russia investigation.
Has this kind of desire to get rid of Mueller, has it gone away over time?
Well, the president has changed his tone towards Mueller. He has, since Ty Cobb came in July, he has really ratcheted back his criticisms, and he has, even as recently as December, said that he thought Mueller would treat him fairly. I think he has been coached to the point that to realize that criticizing Mueller doesn't really get him anywhere. It only antagonizes and only drags this process out. And if he's done nothing wrong, then he shouldn't do that.
At the same time, the other reporter on the New York Times story, Maggie Haberman, called into CNN's Anderson Cooper.
My colleague Mike Schmidt and I just reported that the president last June ordered the White House counsel, Don McGahn, to fire the special counsel, Robert Mueller. McGahn protested and threatened to quit if he was ordered to go through with this. The president ultimately backed down. This is the first time that we know of, Anderson, of the president actually engaging in this and doing what had been seen as an option he was keeping open, and he was very consciously keeping it open last July in an interview with the Times in the Oval Office. He has since said, no, I'm not thinking of firing Robert Mueller. Obviously, it would have created a massive earthquake had he done so.
Over at Fox, it was a bit of comedy gold as Sean Hannity tried to dismiss the story as false, then had to admit it had been confirmed.
Now, tonight, for example, they're trying to change the story. At this hour, the New York Times is trying to distract you. They have a story that Trump wanted Mueller fired sometime last June, and our sources, and I've checked in with many of them, they're not confirming that tonight. And the president's attorney dismissed the story and says, nope, no comment, we're not going there. And how many times has the New York Times and others gotten it wrong? All right, so we have sources tonight just confirming to Ed Henry that, yeah, maybe Donald Trump wanted to fire the special counsel for conflict. Does he not have the right to raise those questions? You know, we'll deal with this tomorrow night. We have a shocking video of the day to bring you, by the way. This footage comes to us from Arizona, where you see that red SUV, high-speed police chase.
In what otherwise might likely have been the lead story in this edition of What's News, the Trump administration said Thursday that it is open to granting a path to citizenship for 1.8 million young undocumented immigrants who came to the U.S. as children.
In exchange, the White House is asking for about $25 billion for a border wall, an end to the visa lottery system, and restrictions on family-based migration, so immigrants only can sponsor spouses and children for citizenship, not parents or siblings. The White House is asking the Senate to take up a vote during the week of February the 5th, just days before the next government funding runs out.
The full details are expected Monday, but the response hasn't been positive. Congressman Luis Gutierrez of Illinois tweeted, "It would be far cheaper to erect a 50-foot concrete statue of a middle finger and point it towards Latin America. Both a wall and the statue would be equally offensive and equally ineffective, and both would express Trump's deeply held suspicion of Latinos." Meanwhile, Trump is in Davos, Switzerland at the World Economic Forum, the first president since Bill Clinton to attend. While there, he was asked about the New York Times report about his attempt to fire Mueller.
Mr. President, did you order Mueller fired?
Fake news, folks. Fake news.
What's your message?
Typical New York Times fake stories.
And he delivered a speech Friday touting his America First policies.
I'm here to deliver a simple message. There has never been a better time to hire, to build, to invest, and to grow in the United States. As president of the United States, I will always put America first, just like the leaders of other countries should put their country first also. But America first does not mean America alone. When the United States grows, so does the world.
And that's a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener funded, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate. For a bit more of what's going on in the news, we turn to our friends at the Talk Media News Service. They're at TalkMediaNews.com. On the line today is Talk Media News Chief Foreign Correspondent Luke Vargas. Hey, Luke.
Hey, Nicole, glad to be with you. And I wish I'd heard the entire thing you had on Davos there so I don't repeat what you just went through.
But. That was pretty much it. I just played a short clip of from Trump's speech. I actually forced myself to watch it. One thing that I thought, he's just not a good speaker. And while maybe there were applause lines built in, but there was nothing. He was like a kid reading a third grade book report to a class, just reading it straight through with his signature sniffs. And, there was not a single applause line in it. There was like he read for 15 minutes was basically it. I heard nothing new. Did I miss anything?
Well, I think what was perhaps newsworthy about it was the lack of any bombshell insults or promises to upend the international order. In many ways, and I think there's a large group of sort of foreign policy commentators who would share this belief that this really sounds like the kind of speech that McMaster and Gary Cohn, his National Economic Council chairman, probably drafted up for him, and Trump just had too many other things on his plate or doesn't have enough of these, you know, crazy folks around him to actually rewrite the speech and make it something entirely different. Because it did not have a lot of the hallmark anti-globalist language that was so commonplace during the campaign and that he's issued at various times during the presidency. In fact, you sort of look at this speech and he looks like he's much more in favor of, you know, sort of tinkering with global trade instead of upending, you know, the international economic order, which is sort of what he's talked about in the past. And the line that really gripped me, and we haven't spoken since last Friday, but on Tuesday, the countries that were working on the TPP deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, agreed to the framework of their new treaty, and they're going to move forward with basically a TPP minus the United States. And I characterized it in the speech as a little bit of trade deal envy from President Trump, because, you know, his trade agenda is so cluttered with all of these promises he's made to everybody from Theresa May to the president of the Philippines, to the South Koreans, to the Japanese, to the Chinese. I mean, I could go on and on. He's told everyone, you're in line to get a new free trade deal with us. And yet trade negotiators are incredibly short-staffed right now. They're already dealing with NAFTA talks, which are way behind schedule and may not even get finished. And here you have the TPP advancing a lot of these countries' joint interests in a deal that was basically written for the United States. And he said in this speech, we would consider negotiating with TPP countries, this is a quote, either individually or perhaps as a group, if it is in the interests of all. That is a huge change in tone. Now, I don't think he's actually going to see that through because his base has been led to reject any mention of the TPP, but it is still a kind of a conciliatory statement from someone who's been so inclined to rail against that deal for many years now.
Oh, yeah. And didn't he say something the other day? I like bilateral. It's like he just learned what the word bilateral means because he used it. I like bilateral because it's easier to negotiate with just one other country. But he used the word bilateral three or four times in one sentence.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot to learn, isn't there?
Yeah, for him, yeah. now
I didn't see that.
There was confusion about where Trump stands on immigration reform. There was just on Twitter a little while ago, a staffer for Dick Durbin put out a tweet saying that the White House has canceled. Here, the White House just canceled Monday's briefing on its immigration plan. Kelly and Nielsen were set to brief Durbin, Cornyn, Hoyer, and McCarthy. Given the rollout yesterday, I think we're holding for now, was the quote. We have yet to receive so much as a fact sheet on the White House plan. That's the tweet from a staffer in Dick Durbin's office. So yesterday, They released sort of a framework to the press, but nothing to nothing to the members of Congress who are supposed to be working on this.
Yeah, I had to say I was surprised to hear that they had pledged to put something out on Monday, especially as we started to see the details, if you want to call them that, or the broad strokes of this proposal, because it really goes against what the White House has been saying for so long. I mean, essentially, and you may have covered this with your listeners already, but I think the deal is kind of noteworthy here because, and this is an analysis that Vox put together, which I thought was very well put, they're basically asking Democrats to choose if they want to protect Dreamers in exchange for really significantly curbing legal immigration in the future. And they're trying to pit these different constituencies within the, you know, sort of progressive wing against each other, trying to get Dreamer groups to basically say, yeah, yes, we're going to take this short-term protection and we're going to, you know, pay it down the road by, you know, really dramatically shutting off the asylum process to people from around the world, ending a lot of different types of family-based migration or immigration into the United States. So far, Democrats haven't budged here. They haven't they haven't fallen for this potential trap. You've seen Dreamer groups, including one, the United We Dream, put out a statement saying, our fear, our pain, and our lives must not be used to shackle our parents and ban those seeking refuge. And I think Democratic lawmakers have also not, you know, taken the bait here, but that's certainly a risk down the road. The thing that is still very weird here, and you mentioned this in the beginning of your question, is it doesn't seem like President Trump even knows what he wants.
No.
Or what he's done. You know, he gave an interview, I think it was yesterday, from Switzerland to CNBC, in which he was asked about the whole DACA mess, and he was completely unaware that he created the mess. I mean, he's like living some alternate reality in which he said, and here's the quote, and by the way, the court, it wasn't me. The courts were just not upholding that executive order, which is completely false.
Right.
It was, when President Obama put DACA in, it did not get sued. It was only some subsequent immigration rules that he put in 2 years later that were challenged by several red states. And then that it went into the court system and the White House had appealed it. And Trump basically said he wasn't going to continue defending that order anymore. But he was not in any way having his decision forced on him by the courts. And he was the one that brought about this DACA crisis in March. So I guess when you have such a poor grasp of the state of play, it's not surprising that the White House doesn't really know who to trust here, and maybe even putting out policies that the president doesn't agree with and that it seems the Republicans in Congress are going to have a lot of trouble getting behind.
Yeah. Now we're less than 2 weeks away from, when we run out of money again. There's, in my view, no way they're going to have something hammered out in 2 weeks. I just don't see it.
Yeah, especially because when you start changing the legal immigration system, and especially as you start getting into changes in the asylum process, there are a whole bunch of federal agencies that are involved there. That is certainly going to be something that gets held up in the courts. And the legal objections to those changes are going to be well known to policymakers. That's not to say, again, that the White House or President Trump are going to be aware of the sort of consequences of tweaking the legal immigration and asylum process. But the folks on the various committees, the Republicans on various committees in the Congress, who would be looking at this legislation, will be quite aware of the fact that they're opening up a Pandora's box here.
Oh, yeah.
And so I just don't see how you can get that together in 2 weeks. So I don't know where we go, if this is going to be a promise for true DACA reform that never materializes, or if they'll, I'm not quite sure what is going to be the language that gets stripped out of this quote unquote compromise deal that makes it pass in time. But it seems like they're biting off a lot to deal with in 2 weeks.
And now they're saying that the briefing that they were going to have on Monday is off. So they're delaying it. So, you know, a lot of good that does them.
Well, Trump will give it a long thought over the weekend.
I'm sure he will. Oh, boy. He's on his way home from Davos now. Aren't we lucky? So Julian Assange had a day in court today. I know he's been in that Ecuadorian embassy in London for how many years now?
Since 2012. And his doctors say he is in mental and physical danger if he stays there for much longer, it doesn't take a medical expert to come to that conclusion. He's been basically in an interior room without access to sunlight for almost 6 years.
Wow.
Got to be pretty dire.
Yes. So now he's... Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, so his lawyers are making this case. I mean, the reason there's obviously a risk of him getting extradited to the United States, where the Trump administration has signaled, especially Jeff Sessions early on in the administration, that this is going to be a priority of the administration, was to go after Julian Assange.
Really?
For the WikiLeaks.
But Donald Trump loves the WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks was very good to Donald Trump.
It's a mess. So anyways, we don't know what his legal situation could be, you know, and, you know, there's been a lot of conversations recently between President Trump and the British Prime Minister Theresa May. So maybe this is something they've talked about. It hasn't been announced to the press. But Assange's team is asking the British courts to drop a threat of arresting him. And why he could be arrested by the British authorities is not because of the U.S. extradition, but because several years ago, prosecutors in Sweden issued a warrant for his arrest so he could answer questions about an alleged sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
But he waited out the statute of limitations on that, which expired last year. And so they dropped the case, saying, look, we have no grounds to keep wanting to arrest you. But the British government has not dropped their warrant for him to serve the Swedish request. So they're basically saying, how can you be threatening to arrest us on a warrant that has already expired? Which seems to me, I'm not a lawyer or a legal expert here, that seems to me like a relatively reasonable contention. The British government, I think, is maybe looking at this more emotionally. They're embarrassed that they haven't been able to get this guy, that they've wasted, you know, tens of millions of dollars just sitting outside the embassy for so many years now. And they say, look, we can't set an example where we give you, you know, we let you off scot-free for having successfully evaded the law. So that decision is going to be issued on February 6th. So this whole limbo could drag on if it doesn't go in his favor, but perhaps we get some sort of agreement on February 6th and Assange finally, you know, pokes his head out and the next part of his probably very difficult remainder of his life will begin.
I used to have sympathy for him, but I'll tell you, the whole the WikiLeaks involvement in the 2016 election was very disconcerting, to put it mildly. What else is going on?
His critics would also say he reneged on his promise to leave the embassy and surrender to authorities if Chelsea Manning was released from prison, which did occur. And
yes,
he then basically went back and said, look, there were conditions I put on that basically it had needed to happen immediately. If you go back and look at the tweets and messages WikiLeaks put out at the time, they never mentioned any of that. So I think he got kind of cold feet when surprised it actually happened at the end of the Obama administration.
Interesting. What else is going on, Luke?
I'll say, finally, maybe we can end on a good note.
Okay.
I'm an infrastructure nerd.
Okay.
And maybe I am because I live in New York right now, and the infrastructure here is getting worse and worse every day, especially the mass transit infrastructure. So when I see countries and the European Union in this case making some really, really cool investments in energy infrastructure, I get really excited. So my story of the week, I know you posted a story of the week yesterday on Twitter, but mine is that the European Union is putting $1 billion towards 17 different projects for electricity and natural gas. And the one that's really, really cool and is something that I think energy planners in the United States could take an example from is going to be a new smart grid, I think they're calling it, that's going to connect France and Spain. Essentially, Spain has a lot of solar power, and when it's really hot and really sunny and they're cranking out the solar generation midday, there's often not demand for it at that time in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of this great energy goes to waste. But if you're able to link up Spain with the rest of Europe, and in this case, France, you can get that electricity to places where it's needed. And you just really crack down on the amount of waste. So they funded that project. They're funding a bunch of other ones, including one in Germany that takes wind power from Germany's northern coast and puts it into the south of the country.
Wow.
Another one to take wind power on the Black Sea and put it into the interior of Romania and Bulgaria. These are awesome. And I only learned that this is just 20% of the funds for these sorts of projects that they're going to dole out over the next few years. So this is smart. It keeps, you know, Europe green. It makes renewable energy more viable when you don't have to deal with a lot of waste. And it reduces dependence on Russia in particular, which imports a lot or sends a lot of natural gas to Europe to keep homes warm in the winter. So if you can start to get that energy independence, especially through green technologies, that's certainly a step in the right direction. So
wow.
A little small Round of applause for the European Union.
Very much so. A big round of applause. We could learn a few things from them. I wish we would. Luke Vargas from the Talk Media News Service, talkmedianews.com. By the way, you can follow Luke Vargas on Twitter at The Courier. The Courier. Thank you so much, Luke. It's always great to hear from you.
Thanks, Nicole.
Take care.
Have a great weekend.
You
Talk to
too.
You soon.
Bye-bye. All right. I'm sure the people in California would like some of that green energy as well. You see that as a segue? Because coming up, we're going to speak with a candidate for governor of California. Yep, it's an election year. Delaine Easton will join us in just a couple of minutes. So stick around. I am Nicole Sandler, NicoleSandler.com, and the Progressive Voices Network.
These are the sounds of crushed souls. The sounds of despair from former radio personalities languishing in the purgatory of corporate consolidation. These former radio personalities have lost their livelihoods, not because they weren't entertaining or informative, but because they don't meet today's corporate terrestrial broadcast standards of being smelly, overweight douchebags, seething with vein-popping hatred. These radio refugees and their audiences have since migrated to the internet. But their struggle continues as the quest for monetization ensues. Nicole Sandler is leading the way to reestablishing thought-provoking and entertaining radio. And you can help by clicking the donate button on NicoleSandler.com. Donate today, or as much and as often as you can. Dry the tears of listeners by removing the rotting stench of corporate radio. Won't you help?
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
All right, we're back. Nicole Sandler here, and we're calling Delaine Easton. She is a candidate for the governor of California. And let's get her on the line.
Hi there.
Hi, Delaine.
Yes, hi.
Hi, it's Nicole Sandler calling. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I just got a call, though, from some telemarketer.
Oh, no.
They're now calling my... And I told her I'm expecting an important call. Get off. I just about missed you.
Well, I'm glad it worked out. We are live on the air, and I'm thrilled that you're with us. I have a very soft spot in my heart for California. I lived there for 15 years, and it's still... I still consider California home. I lived in the Los Angeles area from 87 to about 2001. So it's still home to me. California is, I think, it's my favorite state in the country. I live in Florida now, but wish I were in California. So,
well, I hope you.
I'm
my
sorry?
My dad was, I hope you make your way back here. My dad was from Kentucky, and I think he loved California better than anybody I ever knew. He said, Californians are people born somewhere else who came to their senses.
Now, you were born in California, though, weren't you?
Absolutely, yes. My mother was a San Franciscan, fourth generation, and I was born in San Diego where my dad was stationed. So at least I was born in California.
So you are a true Californian. It's the same thing sort of with Florida. I hate to say it. Most people were not born. I wasn't born here. I was born in New York. But grew up down here. And then as an adult, moved out to California. That's where, you know, the best part of my career was, you know. Anyway, we're not talking about me. We're talking about you. So Delaine Easton, for those who don't know of you, what's your background? What got you on the road to run for governor of California?
Well, my background is varied. I started out as a political science professor, and I was trying to write the definitive textbook on California state and local politics, and got involved with, decided to run for office while I was writing this textbook, and going to the city council in a wonderful city. And then I had a chance to go to the legislature at a time. In 1986, I was elected to the legislature. Women in California had had the vote for 75 years, but we'd only had a total of 31 women in the legislature. Total history. And so I ran for the legislature and was elected, and then I eventually ran for and won the office of state superintendent of public instruction, which is elected in California. And I'm the first and still the only woman to have held that position. I stepped away. I ran an institute for at the National Institute for School Leadership back in Washington, D.C., and then I was a Mills College professor. But I watched as California's commitment to education was eroded again. We, you may know that we were one of the most successful states in terms of education in the history of the world. We had made an enormous investment in K-12 and in higher ed, and but gradually, after I left office, they started disinvesting again. So today, California is 41st of the 50 states in per pupil spending, but we are the most expensive state in the union with the highest number and percentage of poor children and the highest number and percentage of English learners. We should be in the top 10.
Yes.
Not the bottom 10.
Well,
the
41st out of 50. That's shocking. I thought California did better by its people than that.
We used to be fifth. We were tied with New York. New York now spends twice what California spends.
Wow.
So I'm, and we're number one in per prisoner expenditure, which makes it even more goofy.
Mm.
I mean, but statements of values. When you're number one in per prisoner and number 41 in per pupil, you ought to have your head examined.
Yeah.
So the best crime prevention program in the world is education. And the best economic development program is education. That's why the Silicon Valley was born here, because we had this stellar education program. So I, even though I'd been off the political stage for a number of years, I decided I would get back in because nobody was talking education. You know, it's all the, you know, bunch of noise about things that are not nearly as determinant of a state's success and the people's success as education is. So I have other issues because I had served in the legislature. I have a stellar record in transportation and environmental safety legislation. I've been won the American Institute of Architects Award for Legislator of the Year for streamlining the construction of hospital process in California, and I crack down on unlicensed contractors, and just, you know, so I'm not a one-note samba. It's not just education,
mm-hmm.
but education is my number one issue, and it should be the number one issue for our state and our nation.
Didn't California used to offer tuition-free college?
Absolutely, and it wasn't just the community colleges. They were zero, but the state university and the University of California had tiny little fees. So when I left to go to UC Davis, the fees were $82.50 a semester.
Oh, wow.
And $165 a year. Now they're over $12,000 a year.
Wow.
And the CSU was $42 a semester. Now the CSU is $6,000 a year. Those are the fees, the tuition fees.
Mm-hmm.
But so if we zeroed that out, we could cut back on some of the incredible debt that our students are coming out of college with. The other thing is graduate school has gone up precipitously. So the I have a young friend who 2 years at community college, 2 years at Berkeley, she got Cal Berkeley, she got her bachelor's degree, and then 3 years at law school at UCLA. Her debt is $248,000, and she went to public university in California.
Wow, that's criminal. No, and no young person should go out into the world with that kind of debt saddled on them. They'll never crawl out from under it.
No, another friend of mine's daughter went back to medical school at UC San Francisco, so a public university, and her debt is $300,000.
Wow.
But I know a lot of kids with 170, 168, 157, 128. They keep stepping up and saying to me, well, my debt's, you know. Somebody said to me the other day, my debt's only $74,000.
Oh, my. Yeah, that's insane. We're speaking with Delaine Easton. She is a Democrat running for governor of California. The website, by the way, is Delaine for Governor. It's like Elaine with a D in front of it. We can follow you on Twitter as well at Delaine Easton. So you're not only about tuition-free college. I want to ask your stance, your position on charter schools, since that's such a you're so big on education, and that's such a big issue right now. They call it school choice, but the question really is about charters.
Well, one of the biggest proponents of charters was Al Shanker, who was head of the American Federation of Teachers. And his intent was a brilliant one. It was the idea that we would have teachers in a more central role in designing the educational program. So the concept is really quite excellent. But the problem is that in California, the bill was poorly written. It didn't have enough accountability in it. So I call for a moratorium on charters. I'm not trying to shut down the good ones that are in business, and I hope someday we can open more. But in the short term, we have to create some better rules and regulations. Right now, we have charters in California that are turning away special ed kids. That should be not allowed. Mm-hmm. And we have charters that are kicking kids out just the week before the testing because they're not doing well, and they're afraid they'll pull their test scores down. We have charters that are cherry-picking kids. And we have crooks who, because the auditing process isn't very good, they don't have to use the same audit procedures that regular public schools are supposed to use. So one of the things that's infuriating to me is that, you know, that we have very high standards for auditing for regular public schools, and the charters are like, we're public schools. Well, why don't they follow those same auditing procedures? So we had a charter in Livermore where they were charging Chinese children from China, $30,000 each, and then they were charging them $1,200 a month to live with a Livermore family, and guaranteeing them entrance to Berkeley. This is illegal, it's dishonest, and they are being prosecuted. But the fact that they were even able to exist because of the rather poor oversight. So I'm for charter schools, but in the short run, we have to have a moratorium on new charters until we can tighten up the oversight.
I see. Well, that makes sense. I mean, what do you have an issue with the profitability, the for-profit charters as opposed to the not-for-profit charters?
Absolutely. There should be no for-profit charters. This is public tax money. So I'm against public for-profit charters. It's it's an oxymoron.
I agree.
And you're either a public school or you're not.
Right.
And if you're a public school, you're not.
If there's money that's earmarked to go towards education, it should all go to education, not to go into line someone's wallet.
Yeah, and it might be somebody out of state.
Very true.
So, right. California taxpayer money to pay somebody in Oregon or Michigan or New York to get money from the taxpayers of California.
I hear you. Other issues that affect Californians right now, climate change is a big deal. We have a president to whom that's a dirty word. California is still recovering from the latest fires and now the floods and the mudslides. And what do we do about climate change? How do you work on the issue of climate change as a governor of California?
Well, first, I want to just tell you, I believe in something called science. Mm-hmm. There, I've said it. I honestly don't understand how the President of the United States could have had the Centers for Disease Control issue a directive not to use words science-based or evidence-based.
Right.
Really. So I believe in science. I believe that we need a full court press, individually as states and nationally as a country, to address climate change. The Paris Climate Accords were agreed by most of the major countries on Earth, and now we look like knuckle draggers because we're backing away. I believe very strongly that cap and trade is a good thing. I applaud Jerry Brown for doing cap and trade, but it doesn't go far enough because it allows you to buy offsets in other states, which means they get cleaner climates and environments than we do in California. So we have to do more to actually get rid of fossil fuels in California. I think we should have a full court press to expand our use of solar. I think we should use more wind power. I think we should use more geothermal power in those states that have the potential to do that, and California does. I think we need to actually have a long-range plan for how we're going to protect our coastline as the oceans rise. You know, California just experienced the biggest rainfall in history last year, but because there was no plan to capture that water, most of it ran into the Pacific Ocean. So we need a long-range plan for water so that we capture the water and re-inject it into our aquifers and find other ways to save it. The truth is that that's much better than the governor's proposed twin tunnels to send water to Southern California, dangers the delta of San Francisco Bay. So I'm opposed to the twin tunnels, but I do believe we could get even more water if we had a plan to capture rainfall when we have these rains. But the other problem with climate change is that in addition to having lost all that water, we then subsequently had these amazing fires followed by these amazing floods. So California needs to be much more nimble about addressing the effects of these dramatic climate swings that we're going through. And as governor of California, I will be absolutely on my toes when it comes to organizing people to take steps to avoid the bad repercussions of climate change and to get California ready to prosper in for the next 100 years.
What do you say to Donald Trump, who is now trying to open up the waters off of all of our coasts to offshore drilling?
Well, I mean, what's so awful about that is that I actually went to graduate school at UC Santa Barbara after the blowout at Platform 9. And I can't tell you what waterfowl and wildlife and fish and various marine mammals that I saw washed up on the coastline because they had been poisoned by this oil. I think it's absolutely reprehensible that the President of the United States would put this huge tariff on solar and then announce that he's opening up all the coastlines and then crass political step, say he's going to exempt Florida and North Carolina. That's politics right there. That's what that is. That's politics. We're going to exempt the red states, but we're going to stick it to the blue states. And I will tell you that I will fight like a absolutely warrior to keep that from happening in California. We don't want any more offshore drilling. We will not allow them to bring it onto our shores if I'm governor. And they'll have to be beyond the 3-mile limit. And we will even fight them putting it out there because they jeopardize this amazing, beautiful, yes, but also ecologically important coastline of California.
Yes.
And meanwhile, we're looking at advancing a form of energy that is poisoning our skies and changing our climate. It's like, you know, the definition of insanity is doing something over and over again and expecting a different result. You know, we know what this fossil fuels do, and we know how bad they are for the environment. And we also know there are lots of other ways we can gain energy, and we just haven't been very nimble about them because there are some big special interests that want to keep doing what they've always done.
What do we do about health care? How do we fix our broken system? I'm somebody who gets my insurance through Obamacare. I'm thankfully knocking on laminate now. I seem to have insurance for this year, for 2018, but I'm worried as a cancer survivor what happens in 2019 and beyond. I'm too young for Medicare. I know in California there was a single payer bill on the table, and something happened, and it didn't go through. What's the future? What do we do about healthcare?
Well, I'll be honest with you, Nicole. Healthcare should be a right and not a privilege reserved for the wealthy. You know, when Franklin Roosevelt first proposed Social Security, there was a bunch of hand wringing, and oh, this will ruin the country and it'll break us. And it's been one of the godsends for the seniors of this country. Medicare also a godsend. Now we have people talking about getting rid of it instead of advancing.
Yes.
I think we have Medicare for all in this country. And when you look, I mean, the dirty little secret that nobody wants to talk about is the rest of the first world pretty much all have some form of either single payer or universal health care. And they are spending less and getting better health care. They have better results. People are not getting as sick. They're not dying. They're not suffering bankruptcies because of their health care problems. And right now we have people that like to start their own businesses, but are afraid because they have a pre-existing condition that if they left their current job, they couldn't get insurance. You know, here's the dirty little secret. Sick people are not very profitable. So when you run an insurance industry as the basis of your health care, they really don't want to have to serve really sick people, and because it costs them money.
Mm-hmm.
So they try to keep them off the rolls. And those people that are off the rolls that get really sick wind up going bankrupt. So, or the public winds up paying a huge amount. I'll just tell you that anybody you know that's ever gotten sick or had an accident in Europe and in Japan, they were amazed at the coverage they got, the care they got, and the lack of cost that was delivered to them at the end of the problem. And Canada is approximately has slightly fewer people than California, but it is providing universal health coverage and spending a lot less than we are, and they have a lower, you know, death rates and lower lots of things. And so I'm just saying we have to end the many aspects of the for-profit side of healthcare in America and treat it as a right and not a privilege of the wealthy.
How do we accomplish that? Is this something that we keep working on a national level to try to get Medicare for all? Is that what you're in favor of?
On a national level, Medicare for all or something similar state by state. But honestly, when you think about, like in California, you have if you add up all of the money we spend for retirees' benefits, for current public employees' benefits, for a host of other Medicare, Medi-Cal, a host of, you know, the various entities that receive already some kind of health care benefit, the number we have to come up with is about 30% of the total cost. Meanwhile, in the end, you would save a lot of money because you wouldn't have these people that don't show up at the emergency room who are very, very sick sometimes as much. The economics are best understood if you look at other countries and what they've been able to save in financial terms. Everybody, be so expensive. It's pay me now or pay me later. And in the short run, it would look like it would increase costs, but in the long run, it'll save individuals and the nation a lot of money and give them a better healthcare system.
How's the infrastructure out there in California these days?
Well, it's not great. I mean, you know, we were the envy of the country in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s, but we didn't benchmark the taxes on gas. Our parents' generation was very generous. They paid about a quarter of the cost of a gallon of gas in taxes, and so they were able to build that amazing system that we call the freeway system. But it wasn't benchmarked, so the gas, as gas went up, the taxes stayed at the same level. And so eventually they passed laws that let counties improve their own roads locally. And like 23 of the 58 counties in California have passed half-cent sales taxes, some more than once. So we've had some local, billions of local dollars go in, but the state hasn't been keeping up its end. So now the chickens are coming home to roost. The old freeways need to be maintained. The dramatic cost of housing has caused people to be commuting much longer distances. So we need to build new and better transportation systems. And we haven't done enough to really think more smartly about how we are going to build affordable housing. What we've just done is gone build a bunch of affordable housing in the Central Valley so people are commuting 2 hours to work. Instead, we ought to be looking at reclaiming some of the commercial industrial property, especially some of it that's down in the heel or not being fully utilized or closed entirely. Get some of the property around transportation hubs and build multi-story affordable housing so people could then walk out of their apartment or out of their condominium or out of their townhouse and around the corner and get on a BART station. That's what we did in Union City. When I was on the city council, we started a process where we used redevelopment to buy three huge corporate yards that were right next to our BART station, which on the other side is the kind of the downtown. So we built now multi-story. It took us a few years to clean it up and get it done, but building multi-story affordable and market rate housing, and people love it because they walk to the BART station. It's unrealistic to say everybody's going to walk to work, but you could walk to a transit hub. And if we build higher density housing near transit hubs all over this country, we could help people to improve the quality of air, even as they're making it easier to get to work. In Europe, it's routine for people to take trains long distances and get credit for part of the time they're on the train for work because they're able to go online and do some work while they're getting to work.
What kind of job do you think Jerry Brown has done as governor? What kind of grade would you give him?
You know, I'd give him overall a positive grade, and I'd give him really high grades in fiscal responsibility, high grades in environmental protection, moderate grades in helping to build housing, but I would not give him, I'd give him an incomplete in education or even a failing grade, because he vetoed mandatory kindergarten. Everybody who knows anything about brain development knows the steepest curve of brain development is 0 to 5. We should have mandatory full-day kindergarten. He's also not restored all the money that Arnold Schwarzenegger took out of child development. And the reality is that California and the rest of the world should know, because we have research that tells us this, the steepest curve of learning is 0 to 5. But the other side of not having adequate child care and child development is that we have people that can't get jobs, can't go to work because they can't find child care for their child. And maybe 360,000 families where somebody's unemployed or underemployed because they can't get child care. Last but not least, we've dropped, when Jerry's father was governor, 18% of the state budget went to higher ed, 3% went to prisons. Higher ed has dropped to under 12%. Prisons are above 9%.
Wow.
So, yeah, while Jerry has reduced the number of prisoners in the state prison, he hasn't done enough to streamline and economize in the corrections field. And he also hasn't done enough to support higher education. He's built virtually no college campuses. Since 85, we built one UC campus out of 10. We built three CSUs out of 23. And we built 9 community colleges out of over 100. But still, at the total of 13 campuses, in that same period of time since 85, we built 23 prisons. 13 colleges, 23 prisons.
Wow.
Those are not my values.
I hear you. Delaine Easton is with us. She is running for governor of California. Now, Delaine, you're running against it's pretty crowded field out there, some with much bigger names than yours, a much higher name recognition. What are you doing to get out and meet the people of California? How are they getting to know you?
Well, I'm all over the state. I've been up to Mount Shasta and down to El Centro, if you know the state. That's the right near the border to Oregon and right near the border to Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
I've been all up and down the coast. I've been to Fort Bragg and Eureka and Twain Hart, as well as to San Francisco and San Jose and San Mateo and Oakland a bunch and San Jose a bunch and Union City. And I've been all over. I've been to San Luis and to Santa Barbara and Santa Maria. And I've been to L.A. a lot and Orange County a lot and to San Diego a bunch. And Fresno, so I'm traveling the state, and when I can be heard, I can be get traction. We've had several debates. We had 2 yesterday. We're having 1 today. By all accounts, I'm absolutely knocking it out of the park at the debates. I'm not. I've been off the stage for a little while, so I'm not as well known. But I'm absolutely the strongest on the issues. I have a very strong background. I have the most experience of anybody. I've been in local government, city council, 2 terms. I was a member of the legislature for 4 terms, and I was an elected statewide constitutional officer. So none of the other candidates have as much experience or are as well-grounded on the issues, and none of them has as strong a history of standing up for what's right. When I was superintendent of public instruction, I called for class size reduction, and Pete Wilson, the governor then, made fun of me and said I was throwing money at a problem. And but I prevailed because I won a lawsuit at $2.3 billion. So he thought he would make it more interesting for me by, instead of doing the 4-year phase in that I had proposed, he said, I'm going to let you do class size reduction, but you got 6 weeks and I'm not giving you any staff or money to do it.
Oh, boy.
Good luck.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Well,
and so we did it.
All right. Well, we're rapidly coming up against the top of the hour. Delaine Easton is her name. DelaneForGovernor.com is the website. I'll put a link up on the blog at NicoleSandler.com. Delaine, it was a pleasure to meet you. Best of luck. You're the only woman in the race, so more power to you. Go out and get them. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Nicole. It's great to be with you.
You too. Take care.
I'm back to California soon.
All right. Thanks so much. Bye-bye. All right. Have a great weekend, everyone.